Quinnell, reel 18.
This we did, and but all this time we were being sniped at from behind. We expected the shots from the front, and we were being sniped at from behind as well. We thought it was our own people sniping at us. But I'm going to jump ahead a bit now. The next afternoon, one of our officers from the who had survived the attack on the right but didn't get through to the objective, went out to find what this where this rifle fire was coming from. There was over 100 Germans in a little slit trench that we jumped over, and they all came out with their hands up. But that's jumping ahead a bit. On the morning of the 5th of August, a German, it was our first experience of liquid fire. On over this barricade on their right flank came a German with a canister of this liquid fire on his back, squirting this liquid fire out of the hose. Burnt 23 of our chaps to death. I plonked one into his chest, but he must have had an armour-plated waistcoat on. It didn't stop him, but somebody threw a bomb, a Mills bomb, and it burst behind him. He wasn't armour-plated behind, he went down. But anyway, the day he'd done a lot of damage. Anyway, the bombers on the right, they bombed the Germans back away from this barricade, and we did, plenty of our chaps were wounded with this liquid fire, as well as those that were killed. It practically wiped out Tubby Turnbull's platoon. Then we got an order from the captain. I hope I never hear it. I know I shall never hear it repeated again. We must make a barricade, and we must shorten our front. So he gave us an order to make a barricade of the dead, the German dead and our own dead, and we made a barricade of them and retreated about 40 yards along back towards my platoon. Now, my platoon was... I got a barricade on my left to look after. There was the front, the Germans, plenty of Germans over there. And this sniping from behind, we couldn't make this out, so we had have our sentries facing both ways and this barricade. I've got these chaps green as grass, and I had to explain to them that one man's on duty, another man's sitting down, another man's sleeping, and so forth. And at any rate, then we had the order to, when we went over, we only had two bombs apiece, which were on our side in our tunic pockets. Yeah. Everybody handed their bombs in to the right-hand flank because that was the danger point. We decided that that was the danger point. And all our bombs were taken along to the barricade there. During the next 3 days, we had five attacks, either at dawn or dusk, from over this barricade. But that night, that afternoon, these Germans behind us were winkled out of their trench. And that night, our pioneer battalion dug a 7-foot-deep communication trench from our old British front line to where we were. And they dug 7 feet down in one night. They must have worked like Trojan. They were the battalion of the Northamptons.
That would be the whole 200 or 300 yards.
Yep. Dug it in one night. I will say this, that the soil there was good soil for digging. But as soon as that trench was dug, up came Stokes Trench Mortar. Now, a Stokes Trench Mortar...
Yeah, know what a Stokes Trench Mortar is. You described it earlier, actually.
Yeah. Mm. And rounds, well, plenty of rounds of ammunition. And also a crew, Stokes Mortar crew, because they've trained, specially trained men. Also, boxes and boxes of rifle grenades. Now, these rifle grenades, they were long, like a pineapple on a iron stem. You've seen them, the first ones, yeah. And that was, I'd been trained for firing rifle grenades. There was a specialist job. You had to be fired with a very, very powerful blank cartridge. We had another consult. By this time, Tubby was wounded. Tubby Turnbull, Sergeant Turnbull, he was wounded. Mr. Fireput was wounded. And that left Captain Caslett and I, we were the bosses. So we had a consultation where to plant this, where to site this Stokes Trench mortar. And after consultation, we decided on that. We put that about 50 yards back away from the barricade. And also, I trained three of these rookies, these young new recruits, how to load and prepare for the rifle grenades. Well, the next time an attack came over this barricade, same performance, a man came over with a canister, he got a very, very hot reception. The Stokes trench mortar opened up and dropped his mortars just the other side of the barricade. I had three men loading up these rifle grenades, and I peppered the whole line. I couldn't miss. I was in the same trench, you see. Peppered it from the 75 yards to 200 yards and come back another 25 yards. In other words, I was peppering that line right the way 200 yards back, and judging by the shouts and the screams, I was taking a very good toll. See, the Stokes Trench mortar was the barrage. That prevented them coming over, and then I was doing the peppering. It worked fine. But we were using so much ammunition. But anyway, the captain sent a runner back and asked for more ammunition, and that night a whole party came up, boxes and boxes of Stokes Trench mortars, boxes and boxes of rifle grenades. Well, all these boxes at the finish, it was more like a timber yard, our trench was. But anyway, we had, all told, we had five attacks. The first one was the disastrous one, which we paid very, very heavily for. But the other four, we took a very, very heavy toll. And we didn't lose a man. Now, the strange part about this engagement was, although we were right in the thick of it, in the Battle of the Somme, we didn't have a shell in the whole 4 days we were there. You see, the men in the trenches, they were so mixed up. Their artillery didn't know where their men was. Same words applied to our artillery. We didn't have a single shell.
There's one thing I wanted to ask you, which we haven't talked about. How did you find the conditions in the Somme trenches compared with the other ones you'd been in?
Once you got away from, once the shell of the egg had been cracked, in other words, the Germans' first front line, support line and reserve line, they were hastily dug trenches, no fire steps or anything, they were just ditches. Just plain ditches, no duck boards or anything of that. And they were much shallower than the trenches that had been occupied for a couple of years.
Because you had to dig them hurriedly as you moved forward.
Yeah,
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. What was the, as far as you personally were concerned, what were the final stages of your experiences in the Somme operation?
Well, the last I saw of the Somme, there were thousands of shell holes. The ground was pitted everywhere with shell holes, and every one of those shell holes, unless it was a shell that landed there very, very recently, was filled to the brim with water. And that was the battle. That was the whole battle scene. It was a horrible quagmire.
And what was the condition in the trenches?
Mud, mud, mud.
Yeah.
Horrible.
After you yourself were wounded at the Somme, what sort of medical facilities were available to treat you and take care of you?
Now, there was in the whole of the war, there was a certain amount of don't you do this and I won't do that sort of thing. I'll give you an example. At night time, the rations would come up on GS wagons, general service wagons. They'd be pulled with horses. All the French roads were pavé roads or cobbled. You could hear in the dark, in the quiet of the night, there's the horses' hooves on the and the iron shod wheels over the. The Germans knew where our rations were coming up. When the wind was favourable, we could hear their ration. But we never shelled their ration party. They never shelled our ration party. Now, the same words apply on the Somme. There was a huge marquee there with a big red cross on it, which was never shelled or never bombed. And no doubt, I think it was done through Switzerland, you know, with the Red Cross Society.
Mm.
And without doubt, the Germans had the same thing. I was taken from the trenches on a stretcher to this Red Cross place. Then at dawn next morning.
Do you have any recollection of what the scene was inside the Red Cross marquee?
Yes.
How were things?
Oh, dozens and dozens of wounded chaps.
Yes.
On the stretchers, waiting to be evacuated, yeah. And the. The roads were so bad there that it was automobiles were impossible. They used some of the old horsed ambulances that were used in the South African War because they could thread their way round the shell holes and that. And by God, was it a rocky road to Dublin journey and in lying on a stretcher and they're thrown about all over the place. But at any rate, these pair of horses, and they got us out all right.
What was the next phase of your medical treatment?
Taken then to a big marquee, which was would be about a mile behind the line. And there I was given the various shots of anti-tetanus and so forth. And by this time I was utterly exhausted, and I went to sleep. And when I woke up, I was being lifted into a motor vehicle, taken down to Railhead, and from there, a train journey down to Etap in the base, which was 40, 50 miles away.
Had you had your leg amputated by this stage?
No. They tried to save it. I had 7 days. 7 days with my foot in a bath of hot water, trying to get rid of it. And I was taken into the operating theatre and tubes put in to drain it. By this time, it was turning septic. Leg was swelling up like a football.
How good were the medical facilities and services?
You just imagine a surgeon perhaps doing 12 amputations a day. The man was tired. He had a butcher's apron on, a waterproof apron, and you were just another case. He didn't even look at you to see who you were. It was all he wanted was just the job.
Mm.
And these wards there, where there were wooden huts.
This was at Etap?
Etap, yeah. Wooden huts, there'd be about 60 patients in there. And the nurses, they were overworked, tired. Everybody was tired.
Mm.
And anyway, they amputated the leg. but they made such a hasty job of it, they left bits of dead bone in the stump, and it was best part of a 12-month before they found the.
One thing which interests me is what your experiences were when you were first fitted for an artificial limb.
Now, that was at Roehampton. Mm. By this time, my leg had... I'd been through hospitals in Reading, and then the very, very nice hospital in the Pavilion at Brighton, and from there to Queen Mary's Hospital, Roehampton. The first leg I was fitted up with, artificial limb, weighed 14 pounds. It was very, very heavy and very cumbersome. But at any rate, I was very glad to have it.
How did you take to it?
I took to it like duck to water.
I mean, what were the problems of getting
well, first of all, the very first day I had it, I had learned to walk again. I'd forgotten how to walk. You see, I'd been on crutches and the stump used to dangle down, you see. And my brain had to tell this leg to move forward alternately with the other one. But after a day, I soon got used to it.
Good.